Blog Talk Radio.
Attention! Army wives, fall in! You are tuned in to the Internet Talk Radio Show designed specifically for Army wives. Our life, our family, our soldier. Brought to you by the Army Wife Network. Interactive empowerment for Army wives by Army wives. It's Army Wife Talk Radio. Up-to-the-minute information is right here with special reports, stories, interviews, and more. Now reporting for duty, your hosts, the AWN Core Team.
Well, hello, Army families. Welcome to Army Wife Talk Radio, the internet podcast designed specifically for you by the Army Wife Network Core Team. I'm your host, Crystal Niehoff.
And I'm your co-host, Amber Bozinski. Today is Monday, September 12th, 2016, and this is show number 579. And we're glad you're here to hang out with us tonight.
Tonight on ABTR, our featured guest is William Groh, author of The Matthews Men, Seven Brothers in the War Against Hitler's U-Boats. You can find Groh on Facebook at William-Groh, or visit his website by going to williamgerox.com. That's William, GEROUX.com. Stay tuned. We've got a great show ahead for you.
And if you're listening to our show live, join our fun show discussion currently taking place over on Twitter. Comment on the show, ask questions of our guests, or just hang out and chat with the AWN Core Team, Army Wife Network. And be sure to use hashtag ArmyWife to participate.
Tonight's show is brought to you by our Army Wife Talk Radio show sponsor, TDP MetLife. While defending our nation, you can protect your family's smiles and save with the TRICARE Dental Program. Enroll today. You can learn more at MetLife.com/TRICARE or call 1-855- METTDP1. That's 855-MET-TDP1. This past week, we marked a major event in American history, the 15th anniversary of the September 11th attacks on American soil. Hey, Amber, do you happen to remember where you were on this tragic day in 2001?
Yes, I definitely do. I was actually being homeschooled at the time, and I remember just, I think I was either listening to the radio or watching TV, and I just kept hearing terrorist attack. I don't know what's going on. You know, I didn't get it. And I had woke up my mom, and I was just like, Mom, like something's on TV. It's something about terrorist attack. I don't know what that means. I know it looks like a big deal. And she's just like, wait, what? Oh my gosh. And she just started freaking out. And I was even freaking out because she was acting this way. And she just started tuning in and listening to what was being said. And then, you know, she turned on TV, or I don't remember if it was a radio TV, but, you know, we looked on the TV and we saw that, you know, it was, the Twin Towers were being hit, and it was just, you know, it was kind of scary for me. Obviously, I was kind of younger, and I was just scared, like, what's going on, and where exactly is this, and not really aware, you know, of what was being displayed. But I remember my mom just kind of in shock and just looking at her face in shock and then crying, and, you know, then I start crying because my mom's crying, and then she kind of explained to me, like, what just happened? What did I just see, you know? And It was definitely terrifying, you know, and I remember just kind of feeling, you know, just my heart broke just thinking about all the people that had lost someone and could happen to us, and it was very shocking for us. What about you, Crystal?
It was scary. Well, I was going to ask you, you said you were homeschooling at the time. What, do you mind if I ask how old you were?
Let's see, I think I was 11, actually.
Wow, okay, so yeah. You would have been about the age of my two oldest kids, who I was homeschooling at the time, and okay. I remember getting up, and I was drinking my coffee while the kids were getting around, and we were preparing to homeschool for the day, and I had my habit of sitting in a certain chair. I mean, I can remember it so clearly. It's almost like it was yesterday. I can remember things mm-hmm. that happened on 9/11, 2001, things that happened yesterday were a little foggy, you know? And I was mm-hmm. sitting there, and I was sipping my coffee. Anybody that knows me knows that that's no shock.
mm-hmm.
But yeah. I had Good Morning America on, and it was just a normal news day, you know? I wasn't really paying too much of attention. And I believe it was Diane Sawyer said, we're switching over now or something to that effect and showing the World Trade Center towers. And the first plane had just gone in, and they were showing, you know, the speculation was it was a small plane. They must have kind of gotten off course, you know, that type of thing. So while mm-hmm. it was like you already knew that this was a bad thing and you just didn't – terrorism wasn't even – I hadn't even hardly heard of that before, except
right.
I was in Southeast Kansas during the Oklahoma City bombing, so you kind of heard that, but I, you know. And then I mm-hmm. was watching as they were showing the World Trade Center and showing it burning and watched the second plane go in. And at that point, it's almost like your heart stops. And mm-hmm. the realization of something serious is going on. You know, that wasn't an accident. And mm-hmm. The shock and disbelief on Diane Sawyer's face and it was scary. It's like
yeah.
you don't even have any feeling at that point except shock. So
right. yeah.
I remember that so well. And the beautiful sun shining in the window, it really was, even in Kansas where I was living, it was a beautiful sunny day. And I was watching some of the coverage leading up to 9/11 yesterday and people that they had interviewed. And over across the country, the one thing that kept sticking in my mind is they were saying it was a beautiful day. It was a sunny
mm-hmm.
day.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have thought something that horrible was about to happen to us? And then just
yeah.
sitting glued to the TV, obviously no homeschooling got done that day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same with us.
It was awful. It was awful. So did your mm-hmm. mom or dad try to, I mean, how did they explain what was going on to you or how were you viewing things as an 11-year-old?
Well, I was, you know, like at first I was just, you know, what is a terrorist attack? My mom was just kind of so scared, like, wait, where is this happening? Is it happening with us? Because I was living in Washington, and that's where I grew up mainly. And, you know, we were just kind of trying to put things together. And then, you know, after she kind of took the time to, you know, soak it in her homing, you know, that a terrorist attack is when a different country, you know, does just basically like a hateful crime toward us. And so I still even then was just kind of trying to wrap my head around it. But I do remember I was feeling a little anxious myself because, you know, there was also the concern of where are they going to hit next? Is that a possibility? You know, is it going to be other main cities or, you know, what's going to happen next? And I remember, you know, just feeling at peace when like we just, our church had this get together right away. They let everybody know about it, and we all went to church and we started praying. And then I felt this peace, you know. And I, you know, being 11, of course, you're just kind of going with everyone else's emotions too. But just kind of that peace that my mom brought after she was freaking out and, you know, tried to explain it to me, just helped calm me down. And it was so awesome though to just see everybody come together on TV, you know, our neighborhood, just everyone just kind of connected. And, you know, you just felt that, you know, like we're a strong country, you know, we're going to get through it. And just to see everyone's support for one another was amazing.
So even as an 11-year-old, you felt that?
Yes. Yes, definitely. I did, you know, even though I was a little bit confused at things, you know, I just kind of felt things around and, but yeah, it was definitely left an impact.
Wow. Well, listeners, you can weigh in. where were you on 9/11/2001? Share with us in Twitter chat. Go to twitter.com/ArmyWifeNetwork and participate. Tell us on Twitter and use hashtag ArmyWife to participate. Moving on to some lighter topics, Amber, a little birdie told me that your hubby's back home after being gone for a while.
Yes, but he's back home. You know, we drove down to Georgia for his OCS graduation. So I drove down with my three little ones, all under five. So it was the smoothest trip. Wow. I'm, like, actually shocked myself because three under five for an 11-hour straight trip was kind of crazy just thinking about. But, he's home, and we're just kind of enjoying each other's company, and I'm ecstatic. We're so happy. So it feels good. It's hard when they're not with us, but it's so sweet when they're finally back home with us for that time, and they're just like, oh, man, it's the greatest feeling, you know.
Oh, homecomings, whether they've been gone for a week or 3 months or a year, it's just, it is like another honeymoon in a way.
Yes.
It's exciting.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, you get giddy. Do you still do that? Get kind of giddy and got to have your hair looking just right and nails done and dressed just right.
Yes,
like
definitely.
You're getting prepared for another wedding day.
Well, when I went down there too, he wanted to meet me at the hotel, and I was like, no, let me get, you know, ready first, because it was an 7-hour trip, and I was in my glasses, and my hair was crazy, and I was just like, no, let me get nice, you know, and I finally let him come once I felt good enough to see him, but, it's exciting. But I heard that you visited your grandbaby over Labor Day, right?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. You know, that is something that I think I'm having a little bit of a hard time with. And so this is my first grandson, brand new baby. I want to watch him grow up. And I'm struggling with finding ways to stay connected. I want them to know me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm grateful for technology because my daughter was like, you can put Skype on your phone now. And I'm like, oh.
Yes.
And sure enough, because she's got Skype on her phone. And so I don't have to wait to be on the computer. If he's doing something adorable, she can call me on Skype and I drop everything. If humanly possible and watch him coo or sleep or snore or, you know, the things that 1-month-old babies do. So that's been awesome. And then we figured out, my daughter and I both get very teary when we have to leave. So we decided that if we take our calendars and plan out the next few months of staying connected, that we do better. So it's not so hard because there is not I'm going to see you at some point or 6 months down the road when I come home for a holiday or whatever. We can say, well, we're going to see, you know, we're going to Skype for sure on this day, if not before. We're going to get back together and meet halfway. It's not just like, oh, we can meet halfway. Mm-hmm. And maybe just a weekend here and there, but we're close enough, we can still meet halfway. So we're finding ways to stay connected.
That's good.
And that is the challenge, I think, of all Army, all military families, or families that have, you know, have jobs where they have to travel. So, looks like it's time for us to take a quick break. So stay tuned, and we will be right back.
We know military life can take us lots of places, and we can vote from all of them. Go to fvap.gov and select your state. There, you and your spouse can fill out the FPCA form to register and request your absentee ballots. When your ballot comes, vote and send it back to your local election official, and you're all set. Visit fvap.gov to get started.
Army Wives, it's not your grandma's army anymore. The military, in this day and age, plays a whole different tune. Army Wife Network is listening. We are interactive empowerment for Army Wives. A network of Army Wives band together by the power of social media. Army Wives supporting each other by utilizing the array of resources available from military and civilian-led support systems. Here's what's going on at Army Wife Network this week.
At ease and check it out.
Well, welcome back. A hot topic in news this week. This year marks the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. The nonprofit organization called 9/11 Day is joining with other nonprofit groups all over America in hosting community services activities. This campaign, called Tomorrow Together, was designed to inspire people to not only remember this day, but to help strengthen their communities. David, president and co-founder of 9/11 Day, says, "Our goal with Tomorrow Together is to rekindle and reinforce the important lessons of empathy, service, and unity that arose from the 9/11 tragedy, and to encourage all Americans and our leaders to work more closely together again as one nation to address the challenges facing our society." In Washington, D.C., 9/11 Day plans to work with the AARP Foundation and other organizations on September 11th each year to help pack more than 1 million meals for at-risk seniors, children, and veterans. To learn more about this, visit 911day, that's 911day.org, and we'll also be posting a link to the story in our Twitter feed.
Now, what's hot on AWM this week? On the AWM blog, you can check out a new series that is introducing readers to the awesome volunteers that make up the AWM core team. The latest article highlights Holly Dobbins, the Army Wife Network social media coordinator extraordinaire. Holly hails from Atlantic Beach, Florida, but has been stationed at Fort Stewart, Georgia, and Joint Base Lewis-McChord, Washington. You can learn more about Holly and our other core team members on the Army Wife Network blog. Read more at www.armywifenetwork.com/blog.
That's right. Army Wife Network is powered entirely by the volunteer passion of our volunteers, Army Wives, just like you and me. And so we're so grateful for our volunteers, and we want to highlight them and let you get to know them because it's a great group of ladies. And it's time for social media roundup. With the kickoff of the NFL season, we asked our Facebook fans, are you ready for some football? The Facebook page was overloaded with AWN fans hashtagging their favorite teams and pictures of everyone in their team's gear. Amber, do you happen to have a favorite football team? Do you watch football?
Yes, I do, with my husband. I'm definitely a Seahawks, 12th man strong.
Woo! Well, I'm gassed. I'm not really a football fan, but my hubby, who's from Chicago, loves all things Chicago, and so he's a Bars fan, as he would say. You got to say it right. And my son, who's just 11, he's a Kansas City Chiefs fan. So we're family divided. So yep. Depending on who I want to tease at the time, I'll root for the other team.
But, oh, there you go.
Listeners, you can join in on this fun conversation by linking over to it from our Twitter feed. We're posting a link in there now. Or by going to our AWN Facebook page and scrolling down. We'd love to hear from you and to see your picks and your team's gear. So head on over there.
And that's it for our hot topics this week. And coming up next after these quick commercial breaks is our new 6th Gen, bringing you the need-to-know stories. We'll be right back.
While defending our nation, your active duty service member can protect their family's smiles with the TRICARE Dental Program, TDP. It's dental protection that's deserved. This dedicated military service entitles spouses and or children and members of the National Guard or Reserve to receive comprehensive dental coverage. But don't forget, TRICARE dental coverage requires enrollment. TRICARE medical program options do not include TRICARE dental coverage. Call 1-855-MET-TDP1 or visit us online at tricare.mil/TDP.
The Breastfeeding Shop is an authorized TRICARE provider for breast pumps and accessories, shipping to all of the USA and worldwide for TRICARE. The Breastfeeding Shop specializes in helping the military moms get the best breast pump possible and prides themselves in providing the best customer service possible, as well as a very quick turnaround time. Check out their easy-to-use online ordering form on their website at www.thebreastfeedingshop.com or call toll-free 866-255-6779. Also visit the Breastfeeding Shop on Facebook and check out the rave reviews from other moms at facebook.com/thebreastfeedingshop.
You're listening to the AWTR Live News 6 Report.
Our life, our family, our soldier, news you can use.
Now, with our headlines, it's our own AWN News 6.
Good evening, Army family. This is your News 6 Jen, bringing you all your need-to-know news. The Army is looking for nonprofit groups to adopt horses from Fort Polk. The U.S. Army is seeking new homes for a herd of about 700 feral horses that roam the grounds of Fort Polk, saying they threaten soldiers who train at the Army post. The Army said fewer than 50 horses roamed the grounds 20 years ago, but the herd has grown as horses give birth and people abandon their animals on the base. Some protesters say the horses were roaming freely in the surrounding Kisatchie National Forest long before the Army took over, but a judge has ruled that they are not federally protected as wild horses and are technically trespassing. The Army has begun taking applications at usarmy.polk.mcom.mbx.pao-public-response@mail.mil. Garrison Commander Colonel David Atley, AFI, is urging people interested to work through nonprofit animal welfare groups, but there's also a sign-up for individuals. New York will begin expediting professional licenses of military spouses. Governor Andrew Cuomo has signed a law to expedite the professional licensing of the spouses of military personnel on active duty who are transferred to New York. The law, effective in 180 days, will apply to military spouses who have substantially equivalent licenses and good standing to practice in other states. It will allow them to obtain temporary practice permits while their applications are pending in New York. It includes professions licensed by the State Education Department, including physicians, nurses, physical therapists, engineers, and mental health practitioners. The law also cuts their initial licensing application fee in half. Military families can expect cuts to MWR programs, including pools and libraries. Soldiers and families around the world will soon see the results of budget cuts in morale, welfare, and recreation programs, including closures of some facilities, reducing operating hours, and increased fees. Officials are implementing a $105 million cut, about 23%, in taxpayer funding for MWR for fiscal 2017, which starts October 1st. We're going to begin to feel some of that impact at the installation, said Lieutenant General Kenneth R. Dahl, Commanding General of the Army Installation Management Command, in a video message to the force. It's up to garrison commanders and senior commanders to determine how to carry out the reductions at their installations, Dahl said. The problem with leaving all the decisions up to the garrison commanders is that there don't seem to be good standards on what the basic level of support services should be, said Joyce Rares, Executive Director of the National Military Family Association. That organization expects to meet later this month with Army officials to get more information about the guidelines for the cuts, she said. Installation leaders have until next Thursday to report on how they will make the cuts, said an Army official, who added that MCOM officials will be watching the situation closely. the Army must divert some of its limited MWR funds for critical post-operating services, such as contracts for security, firefighting, and airfields, Dahl said. Separate from the MWR cuts, the Army expects to eliminate 339 positions in Army Community Services across 75 installations and headquarters over the next two fiscal years, reducing the number of personnel from 1,479 to 1,140, according to one official. Dahl said officials will continue 100% support to child development centers and child and youth services. To the greatest extent possible, we're going to sustain those at current levels, he said. Officials also plan to maintain the current level of MWR programs at remote and isolated installations. We're not looking at scaling back any of the services we provide there because there are no alternatives outside the installation, he said. The impact of upcoming cuts is more likely to be felt in areas like outdoor recreation, arts and crafts, and auto skills, Dahl said. A service might have to reduce its hours or increase its fees. If there are volunteers who are willing to help, and the program or service is conducive to allowing volunteers, there might be no impact, he said. That's all the news for this week. Stay tuned to Army Wife Network's Twitter feed and Facebook page for updates throughout the week. This is your News 6 Gen, signing off.
Operation In Touch offers special savings, coupons, and editorial content tailored to the lives of our active military families, providing useful beauty tips and recipes, as well as news and ongoing promotions. Operation In Touch is sponsored by Unilever and its brands, serving as a resource for American military families who serve this nation each and every day. As a member of Operation In Touch, you'll receive exclusive offers and savings on Unilever products you know and love. Registration is easy and free. Simply visit OperationIntouch.com to sign up today. And be sure to like us on Facebook.
You're listening to Army Wife Talk Radio live here on the Army Wife Network. Our live show is broadcast every Monday night. Join us in our live chat room at blogtalkradio.com/AWTR. Missed the live show or just can't make it? Don't worry, AWTR is available in archived format 24/7 via our website www.armywifenetwork.com or on iTunes. It's interactive empowerment for Army Wives by Army Wives. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Army Wife Talk Radio. I'm your host, Crystal Niehoff.
And I'm your co-host, Amber Bozinski. Tonight we have with us William Giroux, author of The Matthews Men, Seven Brothers and the War Against Hitler's U-Boats. William's writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Associated Press, along with other various regional magazines. He has also worked for Maersk, the largest container shipping company in the world.
But it was while working for Richmond Times-Dispatch as a newspaper reporter that William first heard the stories of U-boats being operated off American shores. Tonight he will share with us the amazing story of the U.S. Merchant Marines and their important role in World War II. Welcome to the show, William.
Well, thank you for having me.
So glad to have you on. Tell us a bit about yourself and where you're calling from tonight.
Well, I'm calling from my home in Virginia Beach, Virginia. The Matthews Men is my first book. Prior to this, I worked for Maersk, the big shipping company, and I spent 30 years as a newspaper reporter, much of it in the Norfolk area, covering the military, primarily the Navy here. And a lot of my friends and neighbors in Virginia Beach here are active duty and retired military and their spouses.
Wow. So tell us a bit about your book, The Matthews Men, and tell us what the book is about.
The Matthews Men, it's really the story of the sacrifices and the heroics of the U.S. Merchant Marine in World War II. The Merchant Marine, as you and some of your listeners may know, is not a branch of the military, but it's the civilian mariners who sail the cargo ships and tankers that haul the supplies for the military, you know, to like foreign battlefields. And I tell the story of the Matthews men through the adventures of a group of merchant sea captains and merchant mariners in a tiny little outpost of Matthews County, Virginia, on the Chesapeake Bay. It's a very, it's kind of a small, isolated place on the bay, and since back before the Revolution, it's been a cradle of sea captains and merchant mariners. And during World War II, a lot of these men were sailing against the U-boats, and a lot of their, and the book tells not only their stories, but the, you know, it tells the stories of their families back home and what it was like for the families to go through this experience.
So how did you first learn about the Matthews men?
I was surprised. It's been like 25 years ago I first heard that U-boats were just prowling right off our coast, you know, sinking ships right off the shore of the United States. And I was fascinated by the idea, and a lot of these mariners would go out and get torpedoed, and most of their ships were unarmed. They were cargo ships. They'd get torpedoed, then they'd survive, and then they'd go get right back on another ship and get torpedoed again, a lot of them. And I was just fascinated by their story, but I couldn't think of a way to tell it. I wanted to find a group of people, you know, a group of men and a group of families that I could sort of follow through the war. And one day I was in a library just thumbing through books, and I picked up an old book, and there was a little paragraph in there that said Matthews County, this tiny little place, a population of about 7,500 people, during the war had dozens of mariners that had sailed against the U-boats, and a number of them had been torpedoed and killed. And I just thought, this is the place. This is how to tell this story. So I started going to Matthews and talking to people.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, since it really isn't a popular American story, it's certainly not one that I had heard about before your book, what was the research process like for you?
Well, there had been some books written, but although really not many, the Merchant Marine is not well known to a lot of people, even in a coastal community like Virginia Beach and Norfolk. A lot of people have never heard of it. But there have been a few books written, and I read those, and then I went to spent a lot of time in the National Archives, you know, looking through files and reports about these sinkings and what happened. And then I just went to Matthews and just started talking with people. And Matthews is the kind of place where everybody in Matthews knows everybody else. So you could go there and say, do you know anybody that was involved, you know, was in World War II and had an encounter with a U-boat? And every person I would talk to would say, oh, yeah, you need to go down the end of so-and-so creek and talk to this fella. You know, his father was torpedoed. Or talk to this guy. He was torpedoed. And I started out with a little short list of people to talk to. And every time I went to Matthews, I ended up with a longer list. And there turned out to be people just throughout Matthews. A lot of the mariners were deceased, but their families were there, and they were, you know, it's a very close-knit community. So it was, if there's ever any place to try to reconstruct a 70-year-old war story that has been forgotten, it's a place like Matthews.
So what surprised you the most when researching the Matthews men?
A number of things. One, I think maybe of all the things, was the encounters after a U-boat would torpedo a merchant ship, and the men would get away in lifeboats or on rafts. Very frequently, the U-boats would surface and interrogate these helpless men in the, you know, they'd just stare down at them from the conning tower of the U-boat, point a machine gun at them, and ask them questions like, what was your ship carrying? Where was it going? But at the same time, a lot of these U-boat commanders, and they were a tough, ruthless group, but a lot of them could not bear to just leave these men out here, you know, to die in the middle of the ocean in a lifeboat. And a lot of the U-boat commanders would give them, you know, after interrogating them, would give them food, water, directions to the nearest land. Some of them would even offer to tow them. And some of the U-boat commanders were just cold as ice, but others were surprisingly friendly. And one of them shocked the men in the lifeboat by the German U-boat commander asked them how the Brooklyn Dodgers baseball team was doing that year. The U-boat commander had lived in Brooklyn before the war with his family and was a Dodgers fan. So it was, I guess, the sort of byplay between the U-boat captains and the survivors of these ships was just surprising to me. There was example after example where the U-boat commanders would show them, you know, a little bit of mercy and just a little bit of humanity in the middle of this brutal war. And that was surprising to me.
Well, out of all the people that you interviewed for this book, do you have a favorite?
I would get in trouble in Matthews with a favorite. I will say that one of my favorites was a guy named Bill Callis, and he was a mariner, and his father had been a mariner. His brother had been in the Navy in the Pacific and had been killed by a kamikaze. He was on a destroyer. But Bill was a, by the time I met him, he was in his 90s, and he was, you know, he was getting on, but he was just the funniest guy you'd ever want to meet. He was tough, and he had seen everything, and he was crude, and he knew everybody in Matthews. And when I first started talking to him, he was a little bit reserved, but after I talked to him two or three times, he was telling me stories that, you know, about people that I really couldn't even put them in the book. So he was just an absolute hoot to talk with. And his whole family was very funny that way and very knowledgeable. So he would be right up there. And sadly, the last time I talked to him, I asked him, he said, you want me to read this book you're writing? You better hurry up and write it. And I said, okay, Bill, I will. But a couple weeks later, I went to his funeral. So he never did see the book in print.
That's unfortunate to hear, but he sounds like he was a great man. So I'm curious, how many people did you have to interview for your book, or did you interview for your book?
I never counted them. I would guess, you know, over the course of several years, probably, you know, maybe 70 to 80.
Oh, wow.
And some of them were extensive interviews. Others were just, you know, people that were, you know, just had a few things to say. Mm-hmm. But I've always enjoyed, you know, just gathering information and just finding little, I might talk to a guy for 5 minutes and he would tell me just one really great little scrap of information to put in the book. And other people, you know, were I interviewed for, you know, multiple times. But yeah, it was a lot because, like I say, everybody in Matthews had some stake in the U-boat war. So you could pretty much talk to anybody and get some sort of information. And I just tried to cover as much of Matthews as I could.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. Well, William, we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, let's talk about what the World War II conflict looked from America's shores.
Okay. Sure.
Listeners, don't forget, if you're listening to our show live right now, the AWN core team is hanging out in Twitter chat. Join in the conversation, ask questions of our guest by going to twitter.com/ArmyWifeNetwork. And be sure to use #ArmyWife to participate and click on the live tab to get real-time chat updates. We'll be right back with more Army Wife Talk Radio in just a moment.
Finding a career that's right for military life has its challenges, but CareerStep offers a great solution. Thanks to MyCAA funding, military spouses who qualify can complete any of CareerStep's courses for a variety of healthcare careers with no out-of-pocket expenses. CareerStep even includes a laptop at no additional charge for most programs. With online courses you can fit around your schedule, CareerStep offers the flexibility required for a military lifestyle. It's a great way to train for rewarding, in-demand careers whenever and wherever you are. Visit careerstep.com/military to learn more today.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Abdullah on behalf of the Army Surgeon General, and this is your Army Medicine, Be As Healthy As You Can Be, Health Minute. September is National Childhood Obesity Month. One of every five children in the United States is obese. While there is no single or simple solution, National Childhood Obesity Awareness Month provides an opportunity for learning about ways to prevent and address this serious health concern. Childhood obesity is a major public health problem and, as a result, is also a national security issue. More than a quarter of the recruitable age population doesn't qualify to serve due to obesity and other health issues. Obese children are more likely to become obese adults. This can lead to lifelong physical and mental health problems, including diabetes and increased risk of certain cancers. Children who are obese also face more bullying and stigma. Parents can help their children maintain proper weight and overall better health by encouraging proper nutrition, activity, and sleep habits early in life. Visit cdc.gov for more information. Army Medicine, one team, one purpose, conserving the fighting strength.
How can I help my daughter with her reading?
Searching for help with Dachshund Breeding.
How can I help my daughter with her reading?
Information on hot water heating.
No. Sarah's bright, but when she's reading, she has trouble sounding out the words.
World music, playing track now.
No.
Let me try. Our daughter gets confused about which details in a story are important.
Which paper towels are most absorbent?
What?
Here are five product reviews.
Why are you not getting me?
See, I told you.
Wait. I was trying to show you how Sarah feels every day. Frustrating, isn't it? Redirecting to understood.org.
For the one in five kids with learning and attention issues, this is what life can feel like. Explore understood.org, a free online resource about learning and attention issues, designed to help your child thrive in school and in life. Understood.org, because understanding is everything.
Brought to you by understood.org and the Ad Council.
Are you looking to reach military families worldwide? Do you have a product or service to offer our listeners? Advertise with the Army Wife Network. AWN has many advertising options specifically designed to reach our military families. Visit ArmyWifeNetwork.com for details.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking with author William Groh. Before we went to break, we were discussing the research process that William underwent to write the book, The Matthews Men. William, Americans don't think of World War II being fought on the American coast. Based on your research, what did the conflict look like from our own shores?
Well, very early in the war, not too long after Pearl Harbor, Hitler sent U-boats right to the shores of the United States. And they were, one of them wrote about he could see the lights of the Ferris wheel on Coney Island from the conning tower. And they would, and ships were torpedoed right at the, how I got onto the story is one ship was torpedoed right off the beach. It was sunk by a mine that had been laid by a U-boat right off the beach at Virginia Beach, where I live. And there were people around still today who were out there on the beach that day and looked up to see two ships exploding, so close that they could smell the oil. There were ships torpedoed right off the tourist beaches in Florida, right at the mouth of the Mississippi River. So it was going on all the time. But a lot of people in the United States were not aware of it, because even though there were a few ships that were torpedoed within sight of shore, most of them were torpedoed far enough offshore that you couldn't, even if you lived like in Virginia Beach or, somewhere on Florida, you couldn't hear the explosions or, see the flames. So a lot of Americans, and at that time, when you think about it, that was in 1942, especially, the country was just sort of in shock. The Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor, and every day there were information in the papers that, maybe the Germans were going to bomb the East Coast, or maybe that we were going to be invaded or something. So the American public was worried about a lot of things, and we're trying to figure out how to fight back and defend ourselves. So the the idea that ship cargo ships were being torpedoed, you know, out in the water somewhere was maybe was not the their first, you know, the main thing that people were that the average citizen was worried about. And the government also went to some lengths to sort of play down the severity of the situation, because we really didn't have the forces at that point to do very much about it. And the forces we did have, we wanted to, you know, put elsewhere. So they didn't want people to think that, you know, the U-boats were just, you know, right in our waters, marauding up and down the coast. So they sort of tried to keep it quiet.
Wow. What were some of the dangers that merchant mariners faced during World War II?
Well, they were pretty, particularly in the first year of the war, before we kind of got our act together. They were, a lot of these ships were sailing, these cargo ships were sailing alone and unarmed, and they were sent out from port to port just in the hope that they would be lucky enough not to encounter a U-boat. But if they did and were attacked, it was very difficult to escape. You know, the torpedo strike, the first one would often come in the dead of night with no warning. The ship, a lot of these ships were carrying explosive cargo or fuel or something, and they would explode. They would sink very quickly. A lot of them were old ships. And the water, I mean, it might be freezing cold, it might be full of sharks, and it might even be on fire, because particularly when the oil or gasoline that a tanker was carrying spilled out, it would spill out of the on the surface of the ocean, and it would ignite, and it would form basically a ring of fire around this ship, and any mariner that jumped overboard would be badly burned. If you did manage to get away into a lifeboat or on a raft, your problems might just be beginning, because you might drift. A lot of these lifeboats, you know, today lifeboats, if you've seen Captain Phillips, they're enclosed and they're built pretty good for survivability. But in those days, they were just open boats, and you might be in one of those boats for days or weeks or even months, exposed to the elements, the rain, the sleet, the snow, the heat, just hoping you'd be lucky enough to cross paths with a ship, or that you'd kind of crunch ashore on an island someplace where you could get help. So it was really a gauntlet of dangers that you had to run. And yet a lot of these guys, when they'd survive, they would go home and they'd get right back on another ship and they'd go out. And some of these men got torpedoed repeatedly. One guy got torpedoed 10 times.
I haven't. Well, you know, it's amazing to me what these men went through. And yet, it's not something that is commonly known to the American public. Why do you think that the merchant marines' contributions to the war have been forgotten?
Well, for several reasons, really. One of them is that, you know, they were not, again, they weren't members of the military, and they were not on warships. I mean, some of them had arm or navy gunners that were stationed on these ships, and through no fault of these gunners, putting a gun tub on a merchant ship was not a good way to protect it against U-boats. And a lot of these Navy gunners died bravely right alongside the mariners. But they didn't engage in, they weren't part of battles that have been, you know, heroic battles. They weren't like trading blows with the enemy and, you know, striking back. They were pretty much victimized and sunk, and their encounters, their deaths occurred not in, you know, battles that have been well documented, but on these lonely encounters out in the middle of the ocean with a U-boat. There was also a lot of there was some animosity toward merchant mariners among in parts of the American public. Some of the people in the Navy did not care for them because they were, you know, they didn't have Navy discipline. They were kind of loose cannons. They sort of did things their own way, and a lot of the Navy people just resented that they were, you know, they didn't follow orders, they wouldn't do things. There were some people that felt they were overpaid because they were citizens, they were union guys, they got bonuses for hauling explosives. But the thing about mariners is that merchant mariners is they were only paid when they were on a ship, and they got paid the minute the voyage started, and they stopped getting paid the moment it stopped, even if it stopped with a torpedo strike in the middle of the ocean. So they were off the clock. They were on their own time when they were, you know, fighting off sharks or swimming for their lives. So there was some sense in the country that these guys were not, you know, they were kind of bad guys, or they were not, you know, they weren't really up to the standard of the military. And in fact, after the war, they were left out of the GI Bill and left out of really any government benefits at all until many decades later, when most of them were, you know, quite elderly.
Wow, and yet they sacrificed so much for our country. Oh, wow. I'm
yeah, they had
that,
their casualty rate was the highest, was higher than any branch of the military in World War II. The Marines were the only ones that came close. Of course, the Army suffered by far the greatest number of casualties. But for the Merchant Marine, one out of every 26 mariners who went to sea was a casualty.
Oh, wow. So I have a question from a listener who's asking, what is the most difficult thing that you found that you had in writing this book and getting the story out?
I think, honestly, it was pulling together the finding. I think what it was really more when I started out. It was like going into Matthews, this tiny community, and thinking, are there enough people around, you know, to retell this story? Because, like I say, this story has not been in the history books. You have to find people to, you know, to reconstruct these sinkings and reconstruct these stories and talk to family members who were at home. What was it like in Matthews to be? And it was an experience they shared with a lot of the military families, you know, of just not knowing what was going to happen, you know, not hearing from their loved one overseas and not knowing it, where they, you know, in the Matthews case, are they sunk, or they, so I just thought, well, how much of this story could you tell? How many people are there still around in Matthews to help reconstruct this story, you know, and how much of the story of the war could you tell? And It took. Sometimes it would take a lot of digging, because not all of these people really wanted to talk about it, and some of them were just bewildered that I wanted to ask them anything. You know, like what do you want? You know, why do you want to know this? So it was, I guess. And once I got going, it got better. But at the beginning, it was, you know, it was sort of digging into a story that had not been told, and finding enough people to tell it the way I wanted to tell it. I don't know if that's a good answer or not, but and it took me a while to kind of reach that point, to sort of reach that critical mass where I thought, yes, I've got enough. And by the end of the experience, I was leaving stuff out because I had too much stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So what was the most rewarding part of writing your book?
I think what I like about it is, since the book has come out, and I went on a book tour after it came out in the middle of April, and I went to a bunch of different places, and everywhere I went, these old mariners or their families would come up to me, and they're still doing it. I got an email today from a guy, thanking me for telling this story, you know, because they had, as you point out, it's not widely known to people. It's sort of a forgotten corner of the war, and it's rewarding to go to places and hear people say that, you know, that even though the book is not about them personally, you know, this is how it was in my family. And one guy in Matthews told me, he said, maybe when your book comes out, my grandkids will finally believe that I did something worthwhile during the war. So I think that's it. The fact that people people appreciate it. People who thought they had been forgotten, they like it too, that their story is told at least through the Matthews guys and their families.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. What is the main thing that you hope readers will take away from reading your book, The Matthews Myth?
I wrote the book as a I consider myself a storyteller. I really like to tell stories, and the main thing I like about it is I didn't write it as like a textbook or as a political statement or anything. I wrote it because I thought it was a great a seagoing adventure story. So I think and it's written that way, I would like to think that people read it and go, this is a really good story. But beyond that, it's sort of what I was talking about before. I would like to think that people would read it and come away from it with a sense that, these guys really gave a lot to the war effort and have been kind of forgotten about, and that they, maybe they'll get some attention. I don't know, many of these men are very old now, as are a lot of World War II veterans or deceased, so there are not really very many of them left, but to the extent that some of them can finally get some recognition, I think that's what I'd like to people to take away from it, other than thinking it's a good yarn.
Well, it sounds like a great read, though. So where can our listeners go to purchase a copy of your book?
Well, it's pretty widely available, in bookstores, Barnes & Noble, and a lot of independent bookstores. I think PX's and Navy Exchanges, and also, online on at Amazon and through the publisher. And I have a website, which is just my name, williamgiroux.com, and you can even go on there, and they have a little button you can push to order it from the publisher. So it's not hard to find.
Awesome. Well, William, thank you so much for being our guest this evening. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to share with us the deep, and thank you for sharing the story of the Matthews men so that we can remember their sacrifice.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you. Have a great evening.
You too.
Listeners, thank you for tuning in. Join us next week, September 19th, 2016, when our featured guest will be Elizabeth Peace, joining us to discuss how military families can help stop child sexual abuse, an important topic that every parent needs to hear.
In the meantime, join us on www.armywifenetwork.com to stay connected to resources, information, expert columnists, and share the journey with many of our experienced contributors, or follow along on any of our social media outlets, such as Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram.
Interactive empowerment for Army Wives by Army Wives. This is Army Wife Network's core team signing out. Have a great evening.
The views and opinions expressed in our show are personal. Army Wife Talk Radio is in no way affiliated with the Department of Defense or any other branch of the armed services, and inclusion in our show does not reflect endorsement by the DOD, any local government, or their agencies. Thank you for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week for another informative edition of Army Wife Talk Radio.